From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Oxford-educated classicist Dr. Spencer Clavin, author of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Spencer Clavin in their conversation.
The second crisis that I address in the book is the crisis of the body. We have this sort of easy breezy materialist mindset, you know, that everything's just made out of stuff. And you can read people like Yuval Noah Harari, who writes in his book, Homo Deus, about the mystery of consciousness. Why is it that if everything is just atoms bouncing around, if everything is just matter, why is it that we have this stream of sensations, desires, loves, dreams, emotions, aspirations? At some point, he says, if everything that happens to us is mechanical, when we, say, run away from a mountain lion, if that's just a chemical reaction triggering other physical movements, then why do we need to feel fear? And yet, of course, the reason the materialist worldview just doesn't work for us is because we do feel fear. It's almost the most immediate experience we have is that we have emotions in this life of ours, right? We actually have what's called qualitative experiences. And try though they may, they can't map that anywhere on a brain scan. They can show you the little lights that go off in your head when you fall in love, let's say, but they can't relate that in any meaningful way to the actual experience of being alive, of falling in love. And so, as I argue in the book, this is the reality of the soul. And maybe when you say that word, you think about like a little floaty ghost in a machine, or you think about some old-fashioned idea. But in fact, in Athens and Jerusalem alike, the idea that there is a consciousness, what we would now call a consciousness that endures throughout our life, that exerts moral judgments, that teaches us about right and wrong, and that perceives things like colors, even as simple as that, but also love and desire, right? That's just kind of a basic brute fact about us. There's no getting around it. And so the question then becomes the exact opposite of Yuval Noah Harari's. He says, well, if we're just bodies, why the heck do we need to have consciousness? And the real thing that people fear and feel and worry about is, well, since I have this whole world, this whole inner life of dreams and desires and reason, why do I need to have a body, this kind of appendage that we seem to be so uncomfortable with and have been since time immemorial? It breaks down, it gets sick, it eventually dies. Why can't I just float up into the pure realm of abstract ideas? And this was a temptation in classical Athens, just as much as it is now with all of our admiration of math and digital space and Zoom. Why can't I just disembody myself? And what this leads to, rather than the kind of pure ascent into the realm of the computer or of ideas, is actually this terrible discomfort with what we really are, which is embodied souls. And where you see this most right now and most clearly and most painfully is in the terrible craze for transgender interventions. People, you know, signing up these young kids, rushing them through these irrevocable processes that are supposed to make your body conform to some abstract notion you have about a floating, disembodied self, right? And so we're going to perform these surgeries, we're going to perform hormone interventions, we're going to do all of these things that end up many young people in terrible regret, discomfort, pain, at lifelong war with their physical selves. And what I say in the book is this is not limited just to that trans phenomenon. This is a deeper thing that we're coming up against, this revulsion that we have at our bodies. And you see it also during COVID when people say, oh, you just, you know, meet on Zoom, it'll be, go to church over Zoom, it'll be better because you won't get all those nasty diseases, you won't have all those terrible threats and problems. Of course, what we realize and what we realized all throughout COVID is that there's something deeply wrong with that idea about ourselves. It's actually a false vision of humanity. The true vision of humanity is the one that we get perfectly encapsulated in the book of Genesis. When God takes dirt out of the ground, which is just matter, stuff, right? This is the stuff of the body. He breathes into it the breath of life. And then it becomes what in Hebrew is called a nefesh chayim, a living soul. You think of the Christian idea, the Jewish idea of the soul as this kind of disembodied floating breath, but you read the text closely, that's actually not true at all. Adam, the first human being, is a fusion of pure spirit and stuff and matter. That's what we are. That's what we're always going to be. It's what we're made to be. And we are God's physical representation in the physical world, made of matter, but not fully consisting only in matter. We are not matter. We are more than that. We're embodied souls. And you can't lose either part of that equation if you want to stay human and if you want to know true joy.
I want to press that just a little bit. When the Eastern fathers were grappling with the question of what sex we were going to be in the resurrection, they determined that the non-corporeal aspect of our humanity does not have a sex. Sex comes from the body. The soul is sexless, and therefore our sex or our internal sense of gender identity comes from the body. So there can, in that paradigm, never be such a thing as a man trapped in a woman's body.
That's a very rich concept. And I've read a few passages, to me, moderately amusing passages from the church fathers. So not the Eastern tradition that you're reflecting on, but passages from the church fathers in which it's decided that we will all be male at the resurrection. But it's a similar notion, I think, actually, that our physical bodies are what kind of give us. There is no abstracted, pure notion of what you would now call gender, this term that kind of came into vogue with the sexologist, some might say child molester, John Money. And you know, this notion of gender is a purely fabricated concept. I think there are, whether you agree with the Eastern church fathers that that's because the soul is actually genderless or sexless, or whether you agree with something like a kind of Thomistic reading of Aristotle, that the soul and the body are simply not the kinds of things that would be in total diametric opposition, right? You can have distinction between the soul and the body. You can see that they are one and the other. But simply what it means for us to have a soul is that we are the first actuality of a natural body having life potentially. And so, yeah, this idea that you could be a man trapped in a woman's body, woman trapped in a man's body, depends on the notion that what you are, as Descartes kind of hints at in his discourse on method and on man, that what you are is a thinking thing. And so everything important, true about you is located in that kind of ethereal space. And what I would argue is there's really no way to square that with our experience or with any good Christian doctrine, that in fact, what we are is spirit woven into matter. We are enmeshed, immersed in matter, and will be so even at the resurrection. That's the whole point of affirming a doctrine of the resurrection, is that the body, even if it will be radically different than we can fathom or understand in our present state, it's not going away. It's not going to be something that we float up out of. The New Jerusalem comes down from heaven into earth. And I think there's tremendous wisdom in that, which, you know, we could do with recovering.
There's two things that you really light on in that chapter. One, you've already mentioned transgenderism, but you also talk about how transgenderism, in some sense, morphs into transhumanism. It's like there's a slippery slope, and on that slope, you go from transgenderism into the horror of transhumanism.
Well, this was made very explicit by a male to female transgender person. So a man who undertook to transition to a woman named Martine Rothblatt. And Rothblatt's book is called From Transgender to Transhuman. And I believe the subtitle is something like a manifesto. And so in the more kind of obscure online circles where this stuff is discussed, you can find it made very plain, but you don't have to go like digging into these little corners of the internet to find it. All you have to do is open up TikTok and find out what the latest pronoun is, because we see this all the time and we make fun of it or we laugh about it, but I don't think that we really reckon with it and understand it. You see people saying, well, my pronouns are pup self, meaning I'm a puppy, or my pronouns are demon self, meaning I am a demon. You have robot pronouns, you have fish pronouns, all sorts of variations upon gender identity that actually take you out of the human sphere altogether. And when you stop and think about it, you realize this is actually the cutting edge of this body crisis. Even as riveting and difficult and painful to deal with as transgenderism itself is, it is only the first manifestation of a much deeper philosophical error, which is the total cleavage of body and soul. And once you have established that cleavage in your mind, which was accomplished by people like Judith Butler, you know, the sort of initiator of a lot of gender theory, once you've really split humanity down the middle between their body, which is this hunk of flesh like any other, and their soul, which is some abstract truth, well, then actually, not only the world around you, but your own person, your own self, becomes just more putty, more clay to rearrange as you wish. And so you do see people, sad to say, deep into this kind of confusion, identifying as disabled and amputating body parts. You see people grafting horns onto themselves and all sorts of other sort of animalistic ideas. And what it really is about is the body crisis and post-humanism or transhumanism.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. Is it closing time for the West? In his new book, How to Save the West, Spencer Klavan warns that the situation is dire, but we face no crisis today that we have not faced before. Summoning insights of Plato, Aristotle, the Bible, and the founding fathers of the United States, Dr. Klavan shows our hope for the future is in the wisdom of the past, wisdom that will improve the reader's own life and can ultimately save the West. To receive your copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive negative superstitions, but CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org. Oxford-educated classicist Spencer Clavin writes, "The narrative that old books are worthless is designed to keep you from discovering that they are not. For when it comes to the fundamental questions we're now facing, the answers that we find through the great ancient traditions are saner and clearer than the options presented to us by our modern gurus. The situation in the West is dire," says Dr. Clavin, "but every crisis we face today, we have faced before, and we can surmount each one." Be sure to read How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Spencer Clavin, as they continue their conversation.
So you do see people, sad to say, deep into this kind of confusion, identifying as disabled and amputating body parts. You see people grafting horns onto themselves and all sorts of other sort of animalistic ideas. And what it really is about is the body crisis and post-humanism or transhumanism, which is a very explicit philosophy among some of these communities, is just the kind of logical, horrific next step. Just as the reality crisis blows the doors open on true and false, the body crisis blows the doors open on human identity and human personhood. Eventually, you end up with no North Star, no guiding light, no ground to stand on at all. Just whatever thought happens to occur to you in this moment is the thing that you feel you need to embody or seek out. And that is a route that is already causing all sorts of devastation and pain. So I'd say there's no reason why we need to go any further down that route as is now being offered to us.
Yeah, there's so much treasure that we could unpack in that particular chapter as well. Transgenderism, transhumanism, but you have to get the book to figure that out because we simply don't have time on the podcast. It's really worth reading. How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom from Five Modern Crises. I want to get to the third of the crises that you deal with in the book, the crises of meaning. What is that?
Well, this is something that touches on a lot of our debates that you might put under the heading of the culture war, right? And we hear that term thrown around a lot, I think. And as people who are conservative, who tend to lean right, I think we typically feel like we're losing the culture war, right? That's the general feeling that I sense, the attitude, especially after 2020 with that kind of neo-Marxist cultural revolution we all went through, that now with, you know, cancel culture, and especially with art, the movies, and the music that we see kind of coming out of our major cultural centers, we start to feel as if there's been this total breakdown in what art is considered beautiful, what art is considered valuable, moral, what have you. And for a long time, that fight was proposed. It was sort of described in this way. You've got conservatives who feel like they just want to establish their morality in art. They want to fight for a more moral, artistic world. And then you've got liberals who are, like the name says, they're liberals, right? They don't want any moral rules about what you can and can't show in art. Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, famous novel about a child molester, he said that he was just writing art for aesthetic bliss, right? Just kind of pure, whatever delights him, that's what he's making. There's no morals, there's no, you know, ethics involved in art. And it may be that for a while, that was the fight we were in. But if you take a fresh look at the culture wars, what you'll realize is that's actually not an accurate description of what's going on right now. It's not moralist conservatives and libertine leftists. Because when you listen to leftists talk about art and culture, they have very strict moral rules as well, right? You need to make sure that you have a certain racial makeup, a certain number of minorities in leading roles, right? You must absolutely ensure that no negative messages are conveyed about those people who are minorities in those roles. There probably ought to be some non-traditional sexual arrangements involved. These are moral codes. They're not moral in the sense of being morally good, but they are ideas about morality that are very strongly enforced, both in terms of what gets made and in terms of what gets praised, right? You have to make stuff this way, is what the left is saying. You have to show the world this way. And so that's why what we're really up against is a crisis of meaning, because what we're actually dealing with are two incompatible moral visions of the world that the left is trying to enforce one through art, and we on the right, or we conservatives, are attempting to enforce what we believe is a truer, or to enact a truer idea about morals in art. And that finally leads us to this real question, which is, what's art supposed to do anyway? Why do we go to the movies? Why do we listen to music? Why do we do all this stuff? The reason is because it reflects life back to us. This is the concept known in Greek philosophy as mimesis, imitation, replication. And when you dig into this concept, you find that it actually goes way, way deep, way down to really the bottom of everything we do. Mimesis, imitation. Aristotle says mankind is the most imitative of animals. He imitates from childhood. And you see this in preschools. You go into kindergarten, people are learning by repeating songs back at their teacher. And Wordsworth, the poet, has this beautiful line about an infant babe looking up into his mother's eyes and receiving humanity from his mother's face because she smiles at him until he smiles back, right? This is a core part of who we are and what we are. And it's why we do art even in the first place. And so, of course, as I sort of hint throughout the book, but really kind of get into here, really the question of meaning is the question of what are we imitating? And so it becomes the question of God. If humankind is an image-making animal, if we are in some sense even images, what are we images of? And that's why we're fighting over art so passionately. It's not because this or that movie is good or bad. It's because we are in a deep, deep struggle over the question of meaning, of what humanity is, and therefore what kind of art we should make about life.
It's so interesting if you look at academia today. Academia says there is no meaning in many contexts. For example, I've often quoted the vaunted professor of philosophy at Duke. His name is Dr. Alex Rosenberg. And let me paraphrase a little bit of what he says. He says, what is the meaning or the purpose of the universe? And he answers his question rhetorically by saying, there is none. Is there such thing as morality? No. He says, anything goes. There's no intrinsic moral value. Everything is nihilism. Is there purpose to life? No, there is none. Is there meaning to life? Of course not. Is there a soul? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? Anything goes. Does history have meaning or purpose? Talk about the crisis of meaning. No, history is full of sound and fury. It ultimately signifies nothing. That's kind of the water we swim in today. It's the air that we breathe. And I think it really personifies the horror of life without meaning. And it is a microcosm of the crisis of meaning.
That's beautifully put. In the book, the figure that I deal with in this respect is Richard Dawkins, big, you know, very famous kind of scientist, philosopher of science. His book, The Selfish Gene, made a really big splash when it came out, and indeed kind of reinvigorated this notion of mimesis, imitation, by taking the concepts of evolution and applying them to culture in what Dawkins called the meme. This is where we get our word meme, you know, that we now spread online. When you spread a meme online, right, it comes from that Greek word mimesis, means thing that you can replicate over and over again. And if it's successful, it survives, right? And Dawkins basically reanimates this ancient idea, which you can find in Plato, that the whole universe is kind of one big replication machine, but with this one crucial difference, that's just as your, you know, Duke philosophy philosopher says that what's the point? What's the meaning of it all? Nothing, right? It just happens. It just is. And the reason that it's important to understand that that is the express philosophy that operates in kind of pop culture is because it goes right to the heart of not science itself, but what science has become, what it has been used to mean in public life. When Dr. Fauci said, you know, I am the science, I represent the science, I think he said at some point during COVID. When he said that, everybody that knows anything about science said, well, no person is the science, right? Science is a process of inquiry. Things can be proven wrong, right? You can argue. But what he meant by that is that I am the keeper of the equations to hack the universe. I am the one who knows the rules of good and bad, and therefore there is no debate. The science is settled, right? Climate change is coming. You all need to stick in your homes. You need to stop having children. You need to eat the bugs. You need to live in the pod. And the reason that Fauci thinks he can say that with such certainty is because he is operating according to this idea of the mechanistic universe. And I deal with this in some detail in the book that, you know, the notion that everything is just matter, it's just physical, it's just stuff. That notion comes along with a conviction that everything behaves according to predictable rules. And what these guys never answer, Stephen Hawking made exactly the same argument in the Wall Street Journal, and these guys never answer the question, where do the rules come from?
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises by Dr. Spencer Klavan. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI.